The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's been said that the Buddha was born under a tree and that he was enlightened under a tree, that he often taught under trees, and that he died under trees. One story is told of when he recognized that this person was ripe for his deepest teachings. In order to give those teachings, he took the person deep into the woods and to sit in a grove of sal trees. So out there is not loud enough. So is the sound coming at all out there? So is it louder now? Is it better now? You still can't hear out there? You can hear now. Okay. So these sal trees are kind of like the redwood trees of India. They're very majestic and tall. And so we have here, just a few miles from us, majestic redwood trees. And yesterday morning, I went for a walk in them. And it's quite spectacular to do what's called in Japan forest bathing. To go in an environment where the atmosphere is such that it's so refreshing and healing and settling and quiet that it feels like you're a little getting a bath of the atmosphere of goodness, of peace or something. And it was lovely to go walking in these little groves and stand in the groves and feel it was early in the morning. It was very quiet, very peaceful, wonderful cool now that the days are warm. And it was easy to feel, kind of like in meditation, the world around us, the preoccupations of the mind, the engagement with the preoccupations of thoughts and ideas kind of recede as kind of an atmosphere of well-being, of peace, of refreshment, became more prominent, more predominant than preoccupations, concerns of life and all that. And this reference point of the peace of being in a natural setting, in my mind, is in the background of the teachings of the Buddha. If you go back to read these ancient texts, some of them can seem fairly dry, but some of them seem to represent the atmosphere or the kind of the inner atmosphere of those people who are practicing. And it's often associated with being in the woods or a kind of state that's like being in the peaceful woods. The Buddha would often encourage people when he encouraged them to meditate, probably just as often as he encouraged people to meditate, I think almost always he would add, or introduction to that encouragement, he would say, go sit at the foot of a tree to meditate. And there's something different that happens when you're meditating under a foot of a tree in a peaceful, safe environment than, many other places. And it isn't so much that that's the end result, to always sit under trees, but rather there's something about certain settings that can resonate with our inner capacity to have the same refreshment, the same peace and quiet inside that is really the direction that the practice is going. Probably the most common description, kind of emotional description of the goal of Buddhist practice is peace. And so the emotion of peace more than a worldly state of peace, the inner state of peace. So what I wanted to do was today is to read some poems, verses from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is a collection of verses from the ancient tradition. And being poetry, sometimes it captures a little bit the flavor or the taste or the atmosphere of the people who are practicing back then or context for it all. And I delight in this collection of verses, so much so that I translated it. And after I was in the woods yesterday, I came home and picked it up. And I hadn't actually looked at my translation for many years. And I kind of just sat down and just delighted in reading through it. Kind of somehow about being in the woods and reading it kind of went together. So here are some verses. Delightful are forests where the masses do not delight. There the passion-free delight. So to go into the forest to delight. What a great thing. Delightful are the forests. Yes. Tasting the flavor of solitude and peace, one becomes free of distress, drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. What a great drinking the flavor of Dharma joy. Wow. And you get a little different flavor than if you read first and foremost that the Buddha taught there's suffering, cause of suffering, and end of suffering, and these eight things you have to do to get the end of suffering. You know, those are good teachings, but drinking the flavor of Dharma joy, this forest bathing or Dharma bathing. Sitting alone, resting alone, walking alone, and untiring, whoever has tamed oneself will enjoy being alone in the forest. Peaceful in body, peaceful in speech, the monastic, peaceful and well concentrated, has rejected the world's bait and is called the one at peace. Rejected the world's bait. Is there such a bait out there? Anybody been tempted or noticed that there's lots of bait? But peaceful in body, peaceful in speech, the one who is at peace. So the contrast sometimes in these ancient texts between this peacefulness of kind of forest-like peacefulness is fire. Sometimes they use the word fever a lot. The mind is feverish, fevered, fever of anger, or the fever of lust, or the fever, of being caught up in some way. So here there's a poem. There is no fire like lust, no misfortune like anger, and no happiness higher than peace. Well, health is the foremost possession, contentment the foremost wealth, trust the foremost kinship, and nirvana, the foremost happiness. So what do you think of contentment as the foremost wealth? Your friends can ask you, what are you doing? I'm amassing lots of wealth. What do you mean? The wealth of contentment. What about that? Because if you get a lot of that kind of wealth, then you're really set for retirement. So these next two verses are the opening verses of the Dhammapada. And as such, they kind of set the stage for all these verses. There's something like 420 verses in this book. And so it has, pretty important kind of represents some real essence of these early teachings. And it goes like this. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. So all experience is preceded by mind. To understand this, we have to see that experience is always mediated. The world and what events in the world are not necessarily mediated by the mind. But how we experience the world, how we experience ourselves, is always mediated by our minds, the acts of perception, our judgments, our bias, our assumptions that we bring to the situation. And so the mind is, because it's so important, the role of the mind in how we experience things, the Buddha puts tremendous emphasis, be careful with your mind. And then he gives the example, if you speak or act with a corrupted mind, then suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. Now this is an image, poetic image, of a wagon being pulled by an ox. You can imagine in ancient India, as one of the means of transporting goods around, imagine an old ox and a very heavily laden wagon. It's a lot of work to pull the wagon. And so the idea, this heavy work, the burden of suffering, if you speak and act in corrupted ways, then suffering will come, and it'll come along like a big burden that you have to, the weight of it you carry along. So with that image, listen to the second verse. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. How much weight is a shadow? Is that a burden to kind of take your shadow along wherever you go? It has no weight. It's easy. So this contrast between the burden, the weight of suffering, and the lightness, more than lightness, lightness more than lightness of a shadow, of happiness. So because the mind, your own mind, has such a big role in our well-being, our happiness, and the conditions we set up for ourselves in our lives, the Buddha has this to say. Oneself, indeed, is one's own protector. What other protector could there be? With self-control, one gains a protector hard to obtain. So I think he recognized that it's hard to really have enough self-control, enough self-monitoring, enough self-awareness to be one's own protector. But this is the real protector. You protect yourself from your own suffering. There's something very powerful about watching your own mind, and then you protect yourself and protect that which is most valuable here for you. And then kind of in the same vein, whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. That's quite something. No matter what an enemy can do to you, your own wrongly directed mind can do greater harm. And sometimes it's pointed out that there's ways in which we might have enemies or people hate us, and sometimes some people help them out. You know, they hate us, or they're angry with us, or they're our enemy, and they do things, and then we get feverish. We get caught up in anger ourselves and hate ourselves, and the reaction we have, helps them out. It helps them, helps us suffer. They want us to suffer, and we'll give them a hand on how to do that. Not a mother, a father, nor any other relative can do as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So no one can do as much good for yourself as you can do for yourself if you're self-aware and present and direct your mind rightly. And then the value of self is epitomized in this little, these two verses, these two lines. If one knew oneself to be precious, one would guard oneself with care. So if knew oneself to be precious. So I'm hoping a little bit you get some sense of the flavor or the atmosphere of this ancient tradition, this idea of peace. Maybe the if you have a reference point of the peacefulness in nature and the freedom maybe of being there and dropping a lot of the social conventions and a lot of the social preoccupations we have and being able to breathe easily and lightly and being refreshed. And then having a sense that in that state, in that peacefulness, that we have some responsibility for the state of our mind, the quality of our inner life. In fact, we have more role to play in the quality of our inner life than other people do. And so we can become our own protector of that. We can cultivate this wealth of contentment within. The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control. So it's not easy. Buddha saying it's not easy to do what he's encouraging people to do. The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control. The sage makes straight, as a fletcher, the shaft of an arrow. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes. One does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes. The sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. They say a watched pot never boils. But a watched mind maybe never boils. You know, boiling and fever of anger and things like that. But a watched mind brings happiness. As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise or blame. So here the image of a sage is someone who's really solid, you know, so solid and so in certain kind of strength that in that strength, praise and blame is not going to, you know, catch us and push us around. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. I love the expression as a deep lake is clear and undisturbed. I've been, you know, seen lots of, you know, mountain lakes and clear and peaceful, sat on the edge of them. And I was once in High Sierra Lake with my young son when he was maybe 5, and we were sitting, it was so peaceful, and I asked him to close his eyes and open his eyes and look at the lake, close his eyes and kind of see the lake, it's in, you know, in his mind's eye. And so I guess he did the best he could. I asked him to do it again, and he just looked at me and said, leave me alone. This idea of an imprint on him, this depth of the peace. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed. So here's a kind of a very evocative, I think a powerful verse that points to the Buddha's kind of now, not just a sense of peacefulness, but the sense of real motivation, real importance, real dedication, or real kind of sense of like, this is important to do. Vigilance is the path to the deathless. Negligence, the path to death. The vigilant do not die. The negligent are as if already dead. What's that? So anyway, to be negligent, to be unmindful, to be lost in thought, many traditions, not just the Buddha, says it's kind of like already being dead. You know, some people talk about it being asleep. Many people walk around sleepwalking in the way we're caught up in our thoughts and preoccupations, not really here in the world. And this powerful language of negligence is the path to death. But vigilance here is another word for mindfulness or being clearly aware, sharply aware, is the path to the deathless. Knowing this distinction between these two paths, vigilant sages rejoice in vigilance, delighting in the field of the noble ones. So this idea of delighting keeps coming back over and over again. This joy, delight, peace, and here, and happiness. So these are exclamations, I'm going to read now, exclamations of joy or delight that by the Buddha or by right people back in his time. Ah, isn't it great to have a poem that begins with ah? As I told you, it kind of gives you a little bit of flavor, some sense of it that's very different than kind of a dry scholastic presentation of Buddhist teaching. Ah. Ah, so happily we live without hate among those with hate. Among people who hate, we live without hate. Ah, so happily we live without ambition among those with ambition. Among people who are ambitious, we live without ambition. Ah, so happily we live. We who have no attachments, we shall feast on joy as do the radiant gods. Feasting on joy. So, I don't know exactly how many Buddhist teachings are in these verses, but maybe there's something that's maybe as important or maybe more important for some of us, at least for me, when I kind of came back from being in the woods and reading this and kind of feeling this connection to people quite a time, you know, over 2,000 years ago, who spent their time in natural settings much of their life. Buddhist monastics, you know, spent a lot of time walking in the forests and farmlands of ancient India. Sitting under trees. I'm pretty confident that they were not on their smartphones, that they managed their lives just fine without all the things that require electricity. And perhaps because of that, even, maybe there was easier access to a settled, quiet mind that didn't have the incessant preoccupation with thoughts, ideas, getting things, connecting to things, finding out things, doing things, that sometimes is epidemic here in our society. But there were the concerns that were back then that are common today too. The fever of lust, the suffering of hate, and a lot of things that are just as true back then they are today. And so the people who touched alternatives to those things, people who touched the capacity for an inner life that had refreshment in it, inner life that was kind of like bathing in peace, kind of an inner spring, like an inner bath or lake that, you know, there's a upswelling of nourishment of joy and peace and happiness, contentment, delight. Wow. To have all those together. And to have this as a visceral experience, to know how to kind of relax, let go, to know how to value these inner qualities, to see that they're important and useful. That they're more useful, more valuable than greed and hate, fear, all kinds of things that people are preoccupied with or caught in, there is something within us that's more valuable. And to begin to glimmer that and taste that and touch into that. And for the people who do, there's an amazing line in this text, Dhammapada, that says that people become disenchanted with suffering. Isn't that an amazing idea? I mean, who in the right mind would be enchanted with suffering? I mean, that doesn't it doesn't quite compute. But it is, maybe a lot of people are, because a lot of people suffer. And so that's kind of a challenging idea. You know, I'm not enchanted with my suffering, thank you. I hate my suffering, what could this be, to be disenchanted with it? And I don't know exactly what it means to be, for you or for everyone, to be disenchanted with suffering. And certainly have a lot of respect for the suffering people experience. But there is, rather than solving all our sufferings that we have, there is sometimes an appropriate shifting the paradigm or shifting the orientation by having access to a genuine sense of inner well-being, peace, settledness. That can help some of our suffering dissolve rather than having our suffering be solved. And perhaps some of the greatest suffering that you experience, it's better off dissolving it than solving it. It's maybe more realistic. And so, where do you go to be forest bathed? Where do you go to drink the Dharma joy? And the hope, the answer is in here, in you. So, and if this talk has been nice, you can thank the Redwoods here in California. So, do you have any comments or any questions you'd like to ask? Or
hi, Gail. Thank you for your talk. I'm curious about the difference between resolving and dissolving.
Resolving and dissolving?
Resolving and dissolving. Dissolving.
Resolving and dissolving.
Did you comment on that, or was it just my hearing?
I didn't use the word resolving. Okay. I said the difference between solving and dissolving.
Okay.
So solving problems means to, figure out the details of the causes and conditions that come together, and then rearranging the furniture, or, taking away the something that needs to be taken away to make it go away, and sometimes that solving, often I think of it as something that involves a lot of thinking and sometimes engineering and planning, and it can be, some people get really busy solving their problems, and it's, of course we have to sometimes, and that's an important part of our life, but if we overemphasize that, then we don't allow for something different to happen, and that is the dissolving. The dissolving that happens when we're no longer feeding or wrapping ourselves up in our difficult challenges we have. Sometimes the very attempt to solve is the very thing that keeps some things intact. It's kind of like having, if you have a scab and you keep picking it, it doesn't heal. So sometimes our psychological suffering, there's a ways in which you sometimes keep picking at it. And sometimes one of the powerful things, especially in something like meditation, is to stop picking at it, but let it be. And then allow some inner healing to happen. Allow the inner wisdom to unfold or dissolve or meet it in some way. Is that... there's mic is here. I can go back up and
first, I'd like to give thanks to you, Gil, that you've spent most of your adult life in propagating the Buddhist teachings here in the West in California, and for the wonderful IMC here in Redwood City. What a great gift it is to myself and all the people assembled here and all the thousands of people who have benefited from IMC and you and the other leaders' leadership. A moment ago when you spoke about sitting at the base of a tree, I noticed outside the window to the east, just beyond us, there is a tree, and I felt we were all sitting at the base of a tree as I looked up at it. And if I may be so bold, if we face that tree, we would feel more like we were in a grove. And if this wall here on my right, directly opposite you, were taken out, and you only had some vertical pillars to support it, everybody could face to the east under the grove tree. And again, if I may be so bold, I've been coming off and on probably for 20 years, and almost every time you have to ask if the people outside in the other room can hear. But if we put speakers out there, it would be great for them.
Great.
So please forgive my boldness for making such suggestions.
Well, thank you for the appreciation, and thank you for evoking the wonderful tree we have there. It's only become visible in the last year or so because you know, we changed the windows. It's been a delight to have that light, the tree, the green coming in. And yeah, it would be lovely to have more open here. When we first moved here, before we did some remodeling, IMC had seven doors to the outside, and seven somehow is, to me, is kind of a symbolic number. And I loved that, the idea that we had seven doors to the world around us, because the idea for me was we're really fluid with the world around us, coming and going, and, you know, open, and we're available to anybody to come and go, and at ease. So having it open that way is a great thing. And we're, you know, we're still working on the sound system and trying to improve it all the time. And there is a speaker out there, actually. And but it some of it has to do with my voice. And some things you can solve. But having my voice dissolve too much doesn't work so well. So I know I should probably speak up louder, but so it's a little hard for the figuring out the volume to adjust. And so it's part of our... part of our practice. We have to have something to practice with. The when I was first introduced to this practice of Vipassana, it was in Thailand, and it was in a monastery back then, was in the edge of Bangkok. Probably now Bangkok has gone far out beyond it, but it was the edge of Bangkok, and it was, you know, it was not a quiet monastery. And it's very hard to find quiet monasteries in Thailand and Burma. You'd think that they were really quiet. But so you learn to practice with the noise. But then I went in a couple of times into Bangkok to the headquarters of one of the big Thai sects of Thai Buddhism, monastic orders, and to visit someone. And big complex of buildings, apartment buildings kind of thing. But there was this lobby of resident halls for monastics, big lobby. And come in through the door, there's a big desk, and there's a phone or phones on the desk, and there's a monk who's sitting at the desk who is taking phone calls and yelling to people here and there, you know. And people are coming in and out, and there's steps going up to the different, you know, floors. There's a lot of traffic. And then But then you go in, and the other end of the, from the entryway, the steps going up, kind of on the right, and then on the left, kind of underneath the steps, that's where they had, where they did a Vipassana meditation. And there was probably, I don't remember how many, but 10, 12, 15 people there, whenever I came, who were sitting there meditating in that noisy, busy lobby, doing their Vipassana meditation. And I loved it. That this practice we do can be done anywhere. So here we are. This is our spot under the tree, and we have our own issues with sound and lack of sound, and we'll keep working on it. But what's I think really great about this practice is that the practice is not dependent on the conditions around us. Dependent on how we hold those conditions, and we can hold them better if we discovered the peace inside of ourselves, and that peace then can spread and hold the world. Discover the love inside of us, and then that love can spread and hold the world in its love. May your peace and your love hold all beings. So thank you. So there is today...